Our first question today is, dear Ajahn Brahm, could you please give some advice on dealing with fear during meditation? No? We've got to go through it quickly today. Okay. Fear during meditation. Now, if you come across fear in meditation, well done. Because the fear is the cold face of insight. This is where you're really making progress. This is where you're letting go of some big stuff. Because all fear is a fear of something you're attached to being taken away. All the things which you thought you owned are beginning to disappear, which is what they're supposed to do. So when you come across fear, all you're seeing is your attachments. Fear of losing your body when the body disappears. That shows you're attached to your body. And so when you can meditate, just let your body vanish and disappear, it means you are not identifying with your body. You don't really believe it's yours, so you can let it go. When other things disappear, when weird stuff comes up in your meditation, don't worry about that. I am the expert on weird stuff. And you are perfectly safe. That's the first thing. Have a little bit of faith. I know what I'm talking about. I've been here, done that. And so if you have any weird stuff, I know exactly what it is, and you are perfectly safe, whatever happens during meditation. Because sometimes there's a certain type of meditation, or a certain time in your meditation. I call it when your perception starts to become free. So you can see things you're not supposed to see, feel things you're not supposed to feel. Sometimes you're still in meditation, you feel your body is expanding and expanding and filling the whole room. Or you feel you're rising up into the air or falling into the ground or exploding or whatever. That's just perception. You're not rising up into the air. You're not exploding. It's just the mind, the way you are taught to see things is so narrow. And now your mind is becoming free. It can see things which aren't real, which cannot happen. All it is your perception is playing around. Let it play. Because sometimes we're taught to see the world in such a narrow band that we can't really understand much. So usually you start to have some weird perceptions at first, and after a while they settle down. But in the meantime, it's really good fun. Meditation will be boring sometimes, watching the breath go in, breath go out, and now you're having something interesting happening. It's like your own movie. But just like when you're watching a movie, you're sitting in the seats, you're not in the movie. You know, so, but when people identify with the movie, that's when weird stuff really happens. That's when you get afraid. I actually remember when I went to movies as a kid. You know, in the old cinemas, everybody would be sitting in the chairs and have this big screen. People don't watch it at home these days, or they get it on the internet. In those days, you went to this movie theatre, had this big screen, and it might have been one of these frightening movies where some monster, and it's amazing, the monster would always be going after the girls. You know, the young, pretty ones. The old girls, if you're old and ugly, you are safe from monsters. It's true, isn't it? Look at the movies. But anyway, and so this monster is creeping up on this beautiful girl. And there was always, always someone in the audience would shout out, "Hey, look, behind you." Now this was a movie. It was shot years ago in Hollywood or somewhere. She can't hear you. And if you think that's stupid, all you guys watching a football match, shoot, shoot! You're shouting at the TV set. You know, they may be playing in England somewhere. They cannot hear you. But still, we give all these instructions. And why do we do that? Because we identify with what we're seeing. We're part of it. Even though we should remember, this was a movie, this is probably a replay, a football match which happened years ago. And oh, what's that old joke? This is a really good old joke about this guy was in a pub and they were watching the news, the 9 o'clock news. And on the 9 o'clock news, there was a report. There was a woman who was on the ledge of a high-rise building and about to jump off. And the negotiators were trying to talk her out of jumping off. And one guy sort of tells to his mate, "I'll bet you $20 that no, she jumps off." And the guy sitting next to him, "Okay, you're on. $20 she doesn't jump off." And then she jumped off. And the guy sort of said, "Look, take the $20 back because I saw this on the 6 o'clock news. I knew it was going on." And the guy who lost the $20 said, "No, don't worry, I saw the 6 o'clock news as well. But this time I thought she'd change her mind." You see how ridiculous that is? But, you know what the movie's going to be. Come on, just shoot. You know that you can't, the game's already been played, it's a rerun. But we get so involved. And that's where fear comes from. We're having these amazing things happening in our meditation. Weird stuff happening. Why do you get afraid? Because you get involved with it. Just let it be, it's fine. Nothing happens. So, another example. Years and years and years ago, when I was meditating. I was meditating, I got this nimittas, these lights or visions come up, sometimes start off with complicated ones. And a vision came right in front of me. My eyes were closed, but it was so clear of this demon. And a real demon. The tongue was hanging out. And all the teeth were sharp, like all the vampire teeth. All sharp, dripping blood. And its eyes were bulging out. And what else did it do? Oh, it had a necklace of skulls. Right in my face. Did I get scared? No, I know the mind, how it works. This is just a projection. It is, you make it up. And so I knew I created this image. And it was scary at first. But I'm not going to be afraid of this. I am going to play with it. And so straight away, because you create these things, you just have to have the thought and it happens. I put sunglasses over its bulgy eyes. And then I used to do this at school, doodling. Black out a few teeth so it looked like the monster needed to go and see the dentist quickly. And put a cigarette out of its mouth. And also a straw hat with a flower coming out over its head. Until doing things like that after about 2 or 3 minutes, that monster looked so ridiculous that it disappeared and never came back again. I humiliated it. And I told that to about 2 or 3 years later. This man was meditating in Bodhinyana Monastery. He came to me really, really concerned because he was watching the paving bricks, and out of every paving brick a monster came out. And he was really, really paranoid. What's going on? And I told him my story. I said, "Play with it." And then he came to me in the evening and said, "I had a wonderful day. It's amazing games with all these monsters coming out. I played with them this way and that way." And then after a while they disappeared. He was really disappointed. Now that's how to deal with fear. You're creating it. You have power over these things. So if you do see some really scary images, mess around with them. If you get some monster, make it do like somersaults or something. Or, just put a dress on it. Or whatever it is, and just make it ridiculous. Play. Because when you play with these things, you're creating it. And one by one, it shows you that these are mind-created images. They're not real. They're mind-created. And because you mess around with them, you can have a bit of a game. It's entertaining. And it takes away all the fear. And after a while, it disappears. And when it disappears, then you really get still. So all this scary stuff, you don't have to be scared at all. I have been teaching meditation, I don't know how many years now, I forgot. And I haven't had one casualty yet. I have perfect safety record. And I don't intend you to spoil my record. And you won't, you'll be fine. So, no need to be afraid of meditation. So what happens? Yeah, you get into some strange states you've never been in before. But let it happen. It's great. If you get fear, it's just you're about to let something go and go into a beautiful, peaceful state. Let it happen. But if you really, really just can't let go because it's too scary, use the same technique which, you know, the kid does when he goes to the swimming pool for the first time. A young kid has never been in the water. It's hard enough to stand on dry land. It's only learned to walk, and now the mummy takes it to the swimming pool. Doesn't want to go in. So what do? You put one toe in the water first of all. That felt nice, that's okay. And then you put a foot in and you take it out. That's okay, it's actually quite nice. Then you put a whole leg in. Then you put two legs in and take it out. This is quite nice. And then you jump in. And then the mother can't get the kid out of the swimming pool because he's having too much fun. And that's what it's like going deeper into meditation. Sometimes it's a bit too much for you, a bit too much power, too much bliss, you're a bit scared. So just go a tiny bit in. Just taste it and then come out again. This is nice, this is quite good. Go a little bit further in. This is brilliant. Go a little bit further in. Wow! And then when you really get in, you can't come out because you're having too good a time. And that's how we overcome the fear. Especially when you go into these jhana things, they can be incredibly scary or just great limiters. Because they're very, very powerful. And you think, can I handle this power? The answer is you can't. You have to let go, disappear, and enjoy. And a lot of times, I remember in those early days, sometimes if I was standing here, I could see the jhanas over there. I just, should I, shouldn't I? It's a bit scary, but it looks really nice. No, it's too frightening. But it's really nice over there. No, I can't, but it's beautiful over there. What the hell? And you just go for it. After a while, it's the joy, the bliss, which you can't resist after a while, overcomes the fear. So when fear comes up, brilliant, you're actually doing something. And this is the way to overcome it. Once you have gone through, you think, what the heck was I afraid of? This is nice, this is beautiful. Dear Ajahn, with our respect and gratitude, we would like to remind you, could you please read the question slowly? Then we can get the most benefits out of your beautiful answers. Look, you have to train your ears to listen fast. People can walk fast. Look how fast they eat. So learn how to listen fast. I'm trying my best, but sometimes there's so many questions. Dear Ajahn Brahma... Sorry, I'm being silly. My shoulders tend to ache and the pain gets worse as I meditate through the day. It doesn't happen when I wake up first thing in the morning to meditate. I tried kindfulness by hugging the sore shoulders, mentally massaging the area, and even turn the shoulder area into lots of small beds, but none seem to work. Can you help? Well, there's a very obvious answer to that. When you wake up in the morning, you have no pain. So, instead of like sleeping 8 hours at night, sleep 2 hours a night, 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the evening, 2 hours. So you're always waking up, and then you don't have any pain. Now, okay, it's sometimes when you're sitting, you're holding things tight, you don't know why. But what you can do is actually do lying down meditation. Because obviously when you're asleep, there's no pain in the shoulders. And lying down meditation is fine as long as you don't lie down in the same position that you go to sleep in. Now, I just trained myself. I always go to sleep on my right side. That's how I go to sleep. But if I want to meditate, I lie on my back. Because I never go to sleep on my back. And I've done that for so many years that if I'm on my back, psychologically, you know, my mind knows he doesn't want to go to sleep, so I keep awake. And if I'm on my right side, my mind knows sleep time. I've trained myself that way. So I don't know how you go to sleep, you know, what position you're in, but if you want to meditate lying down, lie down in another position, which you don't normally go to sleep in. And that way you can find that, you know, you can actually meditate very well. And there's no problem at all. And when you meditate lying down, it also means that later on in your life, when you're sick in hospital, you can always meditate in your hospital bed. You don't have to sort of try and sit up to meditate. You can meditate in all sorts of different positions. And it also means that if you've got bad neck or shoulders or something, you can do some sitting meditation, but then you go back to your room, lie in your bed, you know, not in a sleeping position, another position, and you can have a nice meditation. It's one of the four postures, lying down. So that might help. When we chant the Metta Sutta, we wish that all beings be happy. Where do plants and weeds fit in? One person's weed is another person's flower. That's why, actually they're not here today, because we have all these arguments amongst the monks. What flower to plant and what's a weed out? We're supposed to have natives, but natives produce fires. So if you have all natives, it's very dangerous for fires. But if you have introduced species, they're not natives, and so they're destroying the natural habitat. And it gives me a lot of problems sometimes, because I was born in London. We didn't have flowers. And anyway, now, very few people in Australia are native anyway. We're all weeds. We introduced species. Beautiful, that was funny. So where do plants and weeds fit in? It is supposed to be made all beings. So weeds and plants, you know, you can't go too far. Otherwise, you know, if life becomes totally impossible. You know, you can't even destroy a plant, so I can't eat a carrot anymore. So be very careful when you eat a carrot. Say sorry, first of all. I'm sorry I have to take your life, but I need to eat you. Sometimes it goes too far. We have to live, so please be sort of find a middle way. But the plants be happy and well. At least we want the forest to be happy and well. We want the earth to be happy and well. Now that is a very good recollection. So we try and not to make too big a footprint whenever we go to any new place. Try and look after the ground. That's why this area over here, this was actually I'm not sure where this came from. It happened before we came here. This was no trees in this area. It was like an empty clearing. So this is why we decided this would be a good place to build our retreat center. So we didn't have to maybe think two or three trees on the edges were the only ones we had to get down, but the rest were fine. So we try and make sure that we do as least damage as possible. But there has to be some damage, unfortunately. Or another time, I remember when we were building, this is not plants, but ants. We were building Bodhinyana Monastery. And I was building what at the time we called a small A-frame building. And I was a builder. And it was a nice open area, but there was an ant's nest there. And you know, I just was building the thing. And even though it was inconvenient and a problem, I always made a point of not disturbing the ant's nest. You put wood down, make sure it's somewhere else. Make sure you don't push a wheelbarrow over it. And I was so careful for that ant's nest, even though it created 3 or 4 days more work, that when I moved into that, the ants would never ever come into the building. You know, I really gave them metta, and they responded. And then one day some stupid, please excuse me, Anagarika backed the tractor right over the ant's nest. And I was just really upset. And from that time on they started coming into the hut. It's amazing, these animals, they know if you look after them. If you don't look after them, they're not going to look after you. So same with the plants and the flowers. Look after them and you have a nice forest. So treat them as beings. Are they beings? Are they not beings? I don't know, but it helps to treat them as beings. And then, you know, you have a beautiful forest. Here we go. Dear Ajahn, while the Om Mani Padme Hum and 9988 methods help me to stay with the breath, I get a headache after a while. Maybe these methods are best used only when the mind is wandering. Can you advise? Also, where is the best to have one's eyes looking when the eyes are shut? If you get my... Cheers, thanks so much. The last question first. Don't worry where your eyes are looking. In other words, take all your attention away from that question and just let the eyeballs do what they want to do. When you are not watching, then they relax. For example, when you go to sleep at night, you close your eyes. Do you pay any attention to what my eyeballs are doing? You know, when you're laying on the bed about to go to sleep, you just forget about them. So please forget about what your eyeballs are doing, you know, when you close your eyes and meditate. It doesn't matter where they're looking. Let the eyeballs decide. If you really want to, just say, eyeballs, whatever you want to do is okay with me. Wherever you want to look, off you go. None of my business. And then the eyeballs will be natural. With the other two methods, the Om Mani Padme Hum and 9988, I did mention, don't do that for too long. You will get a headache. So now with the 9988, the counting method, now maybe once or two cycles and that's it. Otherwise it's just too much hard work. And the same with Om Mani Padme Hum. I say do it for a minute, just the whole thing. Another couple of minutes, put in some spaces in, increase the spaces. But don't do it for half an hour, 50 minutes, it'll drive you crazy. So if that's not working, then try something else. Now on the thing about asking your eyeballs what they need to do, a very good method which helps you let go of controlling is whenever you get a little problem in your meditation, nothing seems to be working, just pause and ask your mind, what do you want to do? Not what I want to do, but mind, what do you want to do? And you'll know the answer. Sometimes the mind says, I want to go to bed. Then it doesn't matter what time of the day or night it is, take it to bed and have a sleep. And if the mind sometimes says, I want a cup of tea, but you just had one. Doesn't matter. If the mind says, have a cup of tea, have a cup of tea. Sometimes the mind says, I want to go for a walk. Take it for a walk. And what you're doing there, because you ask a question, you're actually being mindful of what the mind needs. And so often, that will solve all the problems of tension, frustration, and meditation. A lot of the times you don't realize the mind needed to go to sleep. And I've used this so often and so successfully. Sometimes a person, they're meditating, they're getting frustrated, nothing is working, they're getting tired, they're getting a headache. And you ask your mind, and the mind says, I want to go to sleep. And you take your mind with its body to your bed, you lay down, you don't sort of put an alarm clock and say how long you're going to sleep. Let the mind decide. And you lay down, have a beautiful sleep, you don't know how long, you wake up refreshed, you have a shower or cup of juice or something, and you come here to meditate. You ask the mind, what do you want now? I said, I want to meditate now. I feel good. And then you go and meditate. You have a beautiful meditation. Some people have the best meditations of their whole retreat by using that method. Why? Because they're relaxed. They're not forcing their mind. They're not controlling it. Your mind is not your slave. It's not your maid to order around. It is your friend, your equal. So please treat it with respect. Sometimes the mind is weird. I don't know why the mind wants to sleep again, but if it wants to do it, it does it. And then you find when you work with your mind, rather than against it, your mind cooperates and you get very peaceful very easily. Too often the reason why we have difficulty meditating, because we're fighting the mind. Mind, today is the day. We're going to meditate. Or else. That's no way to treat anybody. That's why, lots of similes. Okay, doesn't matter. This is a good simile, which I always bring up during the retreat. I should have really brought it up this morning. About one of the obstacles to meditation is you're not treating your mind with respect. The story of the going out for coffee. Imagine that somebody gives you a call one afternoon and say, would you like to come out for a cup of coffee? And you say yes, and your friend says, great, because I found this great coffee shop. I know you like going to Gloria Jean's, but I don't like going to Gloria Jean's. We're going to this coffee shop, which I like. And I know you like your lattes, but I like, you know, short blacks. So we're going to have a short black. And I know that you like those biscuits, but they're bad for you. You're going to have a muffin, because that's what I like. And we're going to sit in the back. I'm fed up with sitting like where you want to sit, in the front of the shop on the street. I want to sit in the back. And your Buddhism business is driving me crazy. I want to talk about politics. That's what I like to talk about. And we're going to sit there for 1.5 hours, because that's exactly the time I've got. Are you coming? And of course, what would he say? He'd say, I've just remembered. I've got a dentist appointment. Oh, sorry, it slipped my mind. Anything to get out of going. Now, you can understand, I hope, the simile. Time to meditate. You tell your mind, we're going to meditate. We're going to meditate on the breath. I know you like meta-meditation, but no, we're going to do the breath meditation, because that's what Ajahn Brahm says. And we're going to meditate not on the chair, not on the seat. We're going to meditate on the chair this time, okay? I know you like the seats, but we're meditating on the chair. And we're not going to meditate in the front, in the back, because that's where I like to sit. And we're going to meditate for 1.5 hours. I know it's too long for you, but I want to meditate for 1.5 hours. We're going to meditate for 1.5 hours. Okay. Now, when you treat your mind like that, of course, it runs away anywhere. Oh, this problem I've got to think about. I've got to think about this problem. Or, no, I've got to find some sleep. Your mind runs away. Why is that? Because you treat it badly. And when you start meditating again, your poor mind says, oh, not her again. I'm getting out of here. Now, the opposite of that, you get another call. And another friend says, hey, are you free this afternoon? He said, oh, I just, Chef, I know I've got a dentist appointment. He said, oh, that's a shame, because you've been telling that coffee shop you always like going to. I just wanted to try it. And you're always saying these lattes are just like, you know, to die for. They're just so delicious. Now, I always wanted to try one. What you like? And then this Buddhism business of yours, and I'm really quite interested. Can we sort of talk about what you're interested in? To sit where you want to sit. And, you know, I don't know how long you've got, but okay, you know, I can sit there for as long as you want. When someone is nice like that, you say, okay, I'm going to cancel the dentist appointment. And you go and sit there with your friend who treats you with respect and kindness. And you find time flies by so quickly, 2-3 hours go past. And, oh my goodness, look how long we spent here. Because you enjoy every moment together with a friend who treats you like that. Now this is what I mean. So you start meditating, or you're standing somewhere, you ask your mind, mind, what do you want to do? If you treat your mind like that, of course the mind says, okay, we've been doing all this meditation business, so let's try some meditation together. And you have such a wonderful time together because you treated your mind with respect, not like a slave. So when it's meditating time, your mind thinks, ah, it's him again. He's such a nice guy. I'm going to meditate with him. I'm going to hang out with him. We're going to chill out together. And your mind doesn't leave you at all. Why? Because it trusts you and it's your best friend. So your mind never wanders. So understand that, and you understand one of the great secrets of how to have a peaceful mind and why so many people fall asleep in meditation or go thinking. Because you haven't developed a good relationship with your own mind. You really think you own it and can tell it what to do. If you understand that, many problems go. Dear Ajahn, final question from me. Now this is, we always have 3 final questions. So this is your final question today, another final question tomorrow, another one. How do you get enough air into your cave? It seems to have no ventilation, and this bothers me, though it's not my business. Of course it's not your business. It's my cave, not yours. Butt out. There is ventilation in there, very good ventilation. So, but you can't see, it's so well designed, but you know, there's air coming in and air going out all the time. Otherwise I'd be dead by now. So it's good ventilation. But anyway, it's none of your business. Dear Ajahn, of the Tripitaka, what is the significance of the numerical discourses of the Buddha? I get the name right. Oh, those are just one of the ways the Buddha taught the Dhamma. Now, he gave so many teachings. So, you know, when they collected them all together, of course you collect things in sort of bundles. And so they have the long discourses just because they were long. And they got the middle length discourses just because they're middle length. They're not too long and complicated. And then you got the Sanyutta, which are all grouped together according to subject. Like, you know, on the five khandhas, all grouped together. On being a stream winner, all grouped together. And then they've got the Anguttara, which is just grouped together by numbers. You know, like the three refuges, the three jewels, or the three characteristics of existence, and the four noble truths, and the five khandhas, and all the different numbers. So it's just some way. So if you're looking for a sutta somewhere, you've got a reasonable chance of finding it. It's just a way of classification. That's all. These days you wouldn't need that, because all you need to do is put everything online and do this search. You know, you put in something like that, like, what's a good thing, like jhanas. You put in jhana, you get all the references come up straight away, but they'd never had that in the time of the Buddha, so they had to classify them all together like that. So very easy. Dear Ajahn Brahm, letting go is important. Do you think people could let go of their past, tradition, culture, identity? Could the Buddhist community let go of their tradition and Buddhist teaching? Could you? Of course you do. Sometimes I don't know where I belong, because I was born in England. I remember every time that plane lands in Heathrow, as it goes over all my happy hunting grounds with all those memories, I feel I'm going home. And when the plane then goes to, say, Thailand, where I spent 9 happy years and I can speak the language, you feel as soon as you come through Bangkok airport, I'm home. And then these days you get invited to Sri Lanka. You know, the great place of tea. And Buddhism. Got to put the things in the right order. And it's like, I'm going home. And Malaysia and Singapore. Look, I was at this conference once in, I forget where it was, but I was representing Singapore, not Australia, because, you know, I'm patron of the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. And I was, officially, I had the little thing on with the Singapore flag. I was representing Singapore. And as I came out of the auditorium, I think it was actually in Hanoi the last time, in Vietnam. And as I came out, they had the Malaysian delegation were taking their official photograph and had this big Malaysian flag. And I was walking past and said, "Hey, Ajahn Brahm," because I go to Malaysia a lot, "come over here, photo time." I said, "Look, I'm Singapore delegation, I'm Australian, born in England." He said, no, "you're one of us, come in." So I was very proud of that. I got my photo in the Malaysian delegation, official photograph. And then, I also live in Australia now, so when I come here, I think, you know, I'm coming home. And now you go to all these other places as well, Korea. You know, I don't feel at home yet in Korea, but you keep getting me over there, and soon I think, oh, I'm back home in Seoul. And it's really weird being a monk, because you don't know where you belong. Oh, also, Indonesia. You go to Jakarta, you know, just get in the traffic there. Just, you know, you come out. I've been there so many times, it's just another home. And, you know, where do I belong? So it's great, so you let go of traditions. And when you go to Sri Lanka, you've got to act like a Sri Lankan monk. So no more jokes. At least, you know, just not in public. And when you go to Korea, the Korean monks, you have to teach Dhamma with a loud voice. That's Korean tradition. Because the last time I was there, I was interviewed on SBS. That's your... Is it? No, KBS. K Korean broadcasting system. You know, the big TV. And I was talking to it's an anchor who's actually quite famous. And I was talking to him just like I'm talking to you. But then when we got on air, you know, he had to do like Korean style interview. Today, we have Adam Brown from Australia. Now, if you watch Korean TV, you know that's what they do. So it's true, you know. It's just so you have to be like that, you know. So it's wonderful when you can actually change your cultures whenever you want, which is very good. So that's how we can let go of their past, tradition, culture, identity, and have fun. So it's great when you let those things go and you just enjoy yourself. Is the natural state of the mind the Brahma Viharas? That's a very good question. When we say the natural state of the mind, when it has no defilements, no anger, no personal desires, the sense of self is disappeared. Now when it gets to the enlightened state, that is all that's left. The four Brahma Viharas is loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. That's all that's left. So in a sense, it's a natural state of the enlightened mind. When there's no self there, that's all you do, be kind. Dear Ajahn Brahm, dementia patients at death. What happened to the four mind-based components of five aggregates of a person with dementia at death? That's feeling, perception, the mental formations, including will and thought, and consciousness. Do they get reactivated? If not, how would they be reborn? Or is that a case of visankara gatang chitang, no sankaras? Not quite. With metta and gratitude. My mother has now got dementia. When I realized over the phone that she is fast heading that way, within 5 days went to Sri Lanka, but she could not recognize me at all. But that was not a problem, as I knew who she was, and it reminded my kindness to me, and I was reminded of her kindness to me when I was a young boy. She appeared to be very pleased. Thanks a lot. That's what happened with me as well, to try and get to see my mum as soon as possible, but you know, it's too late. She can't recognize you. Although, the first time I went to see my mum, you know, she couldn't recognize me at all. But out of the blue, you know, she was talking about something else, she just mentioned the word monastery. And that just shocked my brother. Now, there's obviously a tiny little bit of awareness was left there. But, you know, just the last little spark. But I know what happens at death, because I'm a monk, you know. If you want to know about death, you've got to ask Buddhists. We are the experts. And the reason is because we get reincarnated. And other religions only live once, but Buddhists get reincarnated. So because we have the experience, you know, we've got the knowledge. I'm only being cheeky. Everyone gets reincarnated. So I am a born-again Buddhist. Everyone's born again as a Buddhist, many times. So what happens at death is this thing we call the mind, what they said here, those four aggregates of feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, that tends to use the brain for so many years, but it can exist totally independently. So what happens when death occurs, or rather just before death, the mind basically separates from the brain. And those are the cases, and they are well recorded, when people with dementia, just a few minutes before they die, maybe the last minute, maybe even longer than a few minutes, they suddenly recognize you. And I say, son, nice to see you again. How are you? How have you been? They have clarity. And then they pass away. And one of the most amazing stories about this. It wasn't dementia, this was coma, and caused by a brain tumor, recorded by a doctor in some hospital in the United States. This patient, a guy, he had a brain tumor. It was aggressive. There was no way they could do anything for it. And the prognosis, you could actually tell almost by the day when he was going to die, because the brain tumor would actually colonize the cells of the brain, get bigger and bigger and bigger, and the brain would actually manage to sort of to use its last resources just to keep the basic bodily functions going of heart and breathing. And the brain, obviously, what was left. And everything else would just stop. He wouldn't be able to control his other bodily movements, not control his digestive system, because the brain would just, just do what was really, really vital in the end. He'd lose his memory, he'd lose his speech. And this went all according to what the doctor knew would happen. And so he could actually predict the day when this person was going to die. So all the family were around the bedside. By this time, the tumor was taking up just nearly all of his brain. There's a huge tumor inside his skull. And there's only a tiny bit of brain left just to keep the heart and the lungs going. But it was only a matter of time before there'd be no brain even to keep that going. He'd been in a coma for days because the brain would not use its limited resources to do things like speak or be able to see or hear or anything. He was in a coma. And then, about the time he was about to die, he opened his eyes. He was on his back, he leant up, he sat up, and had a 15-minute conversation with all his loved ones. The doctor said that was totally impossible, but he saw it, it happened. And after 15 minutes, making his last goodbyes, telling everyone he loved them, he fell back and died. And those 15 minutes, he had no brain. He said maybe a tiny bit, but nowhere near enough to remember everything and to speak and to see everybody. It was one of those cases that often happens. Just before a person dies, all the pain vanishes, all the disability goes, and you remember. There was another case, similar, about this guy who, he lost his memory. It was a nice video done by the BBC. In some part of UK, he'd lost his memory, and it was really, really difficult for him because he'd just remarried only about 2 or 3 months ago. And there was his new wife. Who are you? I'm your wife. Are you? He didn't know. And no one knew what caused this. So they gave him all his brain scans, and they could not figure out why he had this sudden loss of memory. Until somebody tried hypnosis. And under hypnosis, he remembered exactly what had happened. And he remembered his marriage to his wife and everything from the past. It was just like normal memory. And he said, what had happened? This was in a small townhouse somewhere in England. He was in the shed in the back garden doing some work when the telephone rang. These are the days before cell phones, the main phone in the house. And he ran out to answer the phone and hit his head on the shutter which was open from the shed. Banged his head. He never remembered that. He didn't remember anything. And under hypnosis, he remembered everything. And they gave him the post-hypnotic suggestion, when you come out of hypnosis, you remember everything. And they took him out of hypnosis, he didn't remember a thing. But in hypnosis, he knew everything. But the brain damage was such, he couldn't remember anything before that event. This is what happens when you get into things like hypnosis. You're accessing the mind, not the brain. That's one of the reasons why it works. So when a person has dementia, if you happen to be with them in the last minute of their life, they'll probably speak to you and remember exactly who you are. It's a very beautiful thing to know. Dear Ajahn, yes, we are not self, so what are we? Mind, nimitta, mind, cause and effect, nature, evolution. Thank you. You are nothing. Isn't that nice to be nobody? That's why the way to address me is not Ajahn Brahm, not Venerable Ajahn Brahm, but his emptiness. Or if you prefer, his nothingness. That's a very... So if you want to address your husband when you go home, you say, hello, nothingness, how are you today? So who are you? You are what we call a process, not a thing. A cause and effect process. This moment causing the next, which causes the next, which causes the next. But there's nothing stable, nothing which has a self-identity, going from moment to moment to moment. If I could use some psychic power and bring, or maybe get Doctor Who. You know, remember Doctor Who? I read they had a 50th anniversary of Doctor Who the other day. But anyway, if you get Doctor Who to travel back to London in 1956 and get me as a 5-year-old and bring me to Perth, to Jarnah Grove, and just put me in front of you now. There's 5-year-old Peter Betts. Now you've got Ajahn Brahm. We wouldn't recognize each other. So who are you? I'm Peter Betts. No, you're not. I'm Peter Betts. No, I am. No, I am. And we'd be totally different characters. What is the same between the person who was 5 years old and the one who's 62 years old? What's in the same there? Nothing is the same. But there's a continuum cause and effect. You can see that whole process, how I grew and developed and got old and got fat. That's my other epithet. If you don't like his emptiness, the other one, which is quite okay to call me, is his roundness. So when you have this, you say, "Dear your roundness, Ajahn Brahm." It's nice being round. And the reason I'm round, I told this I think the first day, but I repeat it now. The reason I am round is because as you become a monk, over the years, your heart gets bigger and bigger with compassion. And as your heart expands with compassion, it needs a much bigger body to fit it. So that's, it's not fat, it's just got a big heart, that's all. Anyway, so what are we? Mind, nimitta mind, cause and effect nature. We're just cause and effect is a much easier way to actually to call yourself. A process. Work in process, that's what you want. Anyway, we'll talk about that later on. Please explain about sense restraint. Does it mean we should avoid watching movie, shopping? Yes. Some people go, what do you go shopping for? I cannot understand women why they go shopping. You know why? One of the reasons is they go to Singapore from Australia, or from they go to Thailand to do shopping. And Indonesia. They come from Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, Korea, to go shopping in Australia. And Australian women, they go to Thailand to do their shopping. And Korea and Indonesia. Why can't you shop in your own country? Why do you have to go somewhere else to shop? It makes absolute nonsense. Because whatever goods you get in Korea, you can get them in Perth. You don't have to go to Singapore, Orchard Road to go shopping. You can get everything right here. But no, we go overseas, we've got to go shopping. That's crazy, I can't understand it at all. And what do you need anyway? This is true story. They're not here, but you know that, oh no, that wasn't that, oh, was it that monitor, the TV screen we got at Nolamara? Was that from Brian Creek, or was that, was Brian Creek. There was another guy, he came up to me one Friday night and said, do you want a plasma screen TV set. I said, no, I don't need a plasma screen TV set. He said, you know, you can actually go and sell it. No, if it's a second hand. He said, not a second hand, it's a new one. My wife bought it just a couple of days ago. I said, why are you trying to give it to us? He said, because we don't need it. Then why did your wife buy it? Because it was on sale. And that absolutely accurate. It was such a bargain. The wife had to buy it. And you don't need one. That's why he had to give it away, but it's a bargain. I'm sorry, but with all the wisdom of a Buddhist monk, I just cannot comprehend that. But I'm sure you girls can. It was a bargain. They don't need it. They had to give it away. Great. Oh, well, anyway. So that is not sense restraint. Can it make our meditation become more deep? Of course it does, because sometimes, I remember this monk, he went overseas and he watched a movie and he said he couldn't get it out of his head afterwards. You know, it just kept on replaying. Same with some music. Once you hear a tune, it gets into your head and it keeps going round and round. Instead of meditating, you know, you're meditating, watching the breath go in, and all these songs come up in your head. Or all these movies which you've just watched. And that's the trouble. It leaves a lingering disturbance in your head. So that's why it's best not to watch the movies. I remember when, I was talking about this, and when somebody said when they watched Jaws. That's right, it was Venomo Mudita. You know, he's from Finland. He said as a kid he watched the Jaws movie, you know, the sharks. And afterwards he was afraid of swimming in the river in Finland. Now look, you know, these are saltwater sharks. They don't go in rivers. But, you know, that was just made him scared. You know, this is just what happens. It just makes us really stupid. So, please be careful. Could you please repeat the three words you explained today? One word has already let go. Patama, Buddha. Patama, oh no. That was the Om Mani Padme Hum. Om, O-M, Padme, P-A-D-M-E. Oh, no, sorry, I've messed up. Mani, M-A-N-I, P-A-D-M-E, H-U-M. And I'm not going to explain the meaning, because if you understand the meaning, you start thinking about it. It's nice to have something which you don't know, and you repeat that to yourself. So, I won't mention the meaning. What is the Pali word for wisdom? What is the English meaning of sadha? The wisdom word is usually panya. Panya, that's a Pali word. An English word for sadha is faith or confidence. Dear Ajahn, how can one not be in control yet instruct mindfulness kindfulness? Because you give control to your mindfulness. Now, it is okay to give a little bit of control in the beginning of the meditation. Just to, you know, set what you need to do. But it's really important that the deeper you go, the less you control. Similarly, of the taxi driver. Suppose on Sunday when you leave here, you have to go to the airport. And Daniel arranges a taxi for you. And so the taxi man comes up in front of the kitchen there, and you get in and put your bags in the back. And you tell the taxi driver, I need to go to Perth International Airport. And don't drive too fast because, you know, I'm a Buddhist, we do things slowly. And don't sound your horn because I've just been on a meditation retreat. I'm very, very sensitive. And I don't want to hear all your talk. I've just been 9 days on Noble Silence. I want to be quiet. Also, turn down your radio about all this information of other taxis. You don't need that because I'm going to the airport. You've got your fare. And please, none of this stupid music on your radio either. I want to sit silently. And when you do left turns or right turns, do it gently because I don't like being disturbed so much. I'm going to be meditating. And because I'm a compassionate Buddhist, if anyone wants to come in, please let them come in. And don't run the red lights because I want to sort of actually stop. Now, if you talk like that to a taxi driver in Australia, before you get to the gate, he'll throw you out. He said, I know how to drive my taxi, you control freak. So if you want to go to Perth Airport, you just need to tell the taxi driver, go to Perth International Airport, they all know where it is, and then you can shut up. And the taxi driver knows how to get there, he'll get you there. You don't need to continue giving instructions every 1 or 2 minutes. There's one of my disciples over in London. I told this story and embarrassed her like hell over a long time, but she understands. Because when she picked me up from Heathrow Airport once to take me to her place in Kent, in Bromley, her son was driving. I was sitting next to him and she was in the back seat. Don't go this way, son. This is a much better way. Slow down. You're going too fast. Don't run that yellow. It took about an hour, and she never shut up. I never in my whole life seen such a backseat driver. And her poor son was always given instructions. Imagine what it's like being that son. Now imagine what it's like being your mind. Always giving instructions to it. So it's okay in the beginning. Mind, get into jhanas. Then shut up. Let the mind do it. Maybe, you know, if you get lost halfway, maybe just Look this way, over there. A little nudge here is all you need in meditation. But what happens? Go this way, not that way. Look, watch the breath. No, not watch the breath because you're doing it too hard, too much will. Let go more. But then I'm sleepy. I better go and watch the breath. But maybe watch the breath this way. Maybe I should do the counting now. No, I'll do it on Mani Padme Hum because I'm thinking too much. But that won't work because I'll get a headache. So I'm just going to let it... That is why you can't be peaceful. That's called control. How is it that some people have good meditation yet can be stubborn, difficult to deal with, while others are gentle and easy to be with but don't necessarily have fireworks in their meditation? Because those people who say they've got good meditation and are stubborn and difficult to deal with are frauds. They have not got good meditation. Because what it is what we've got called spiritual conceit. Some of you have been coming here a long time. It's embarrassing to be honest and say your meditation is hopeless. And other people, you come as a group, you've got your friends. And at the end of the retreat, you'll ask, how did you do? And you say, well, I got jhana. Well, maybe. Because it's embarrassing, you know, when your friend, that's the first time I came here, I got third jhana this time. Ooh. That's unfair. So we've got called spiritual conceit. So people actually say that meditation is good when it's not. And you know, as a teacher, I don't listen to that. I see your behavior afterwards. That tells me if you've had a deep meditation. So people can actually say there's all these fireworks, all these great nimittas, beautiful lights, and they saw the Buddha themselves, and they went into incredibly deep meditation and jhana. And, oh, everything was going on. And I don't... Honestly, I don't listen to that too much. What I listen to is just, I look at their body language and just see just the residue of that state. And that tells me whether the person's got the real thing or not. If they say, yes, today I got third jhana and I was in there for half an hour and just it was a very nice. No way. If you've had a jhana, you come on and say, I love you. Oh, it's a wonderful thing. I just got... Oh, it's so amazing. I just... Now, that is much closer. You know, when... Honestly, when a person gets these jhanas for the first time, you know, afterwards they look like... You know maybe you've got a daughter or someone, they fall in love the first time. And they're all gooey and soft. And, oh, life is so wonderful. I've met this guy. He's amazing. It's that same sort of like high. And just, you know, really crazy. It's really sweet when you see it. You know, that the people are just so high and just emotionally just so blissed out. And when you're in that sort of state, no one can upset you. And you can sometimes try that. You know, when someone comes up and they said they've had a jhana, sometimes I can say, oh, no, you know, that wasn't a jhana. And they say, oh, okay. You do that on purpose to try, see if they can be upset. If it really was a jhana, they can say, oh, yeah, okay. If it wasn't, they say, yes, it was. And then you know it wasn't. Because after a jhana, you're just so high and so peaceful and so joyful. It is, you know, like an enlightened mind, but it just fades away afterwards. You have huge amounts of bliss. And the deeper the meditation, the deeper the bliss. And if it's like third or fourth jhana, oh, you just, ooh. Sometimes you can't speak to anybody. That's why there was, I remember this one guy, you know, he got into a jhana at the Saturday afternoon meditation once. And, you know, we have a caretaker there, Lynn Jackson. Really good on you, Lynn, because he was meditating there. Well, after we finished off, he was still meditating there till about 5 o'clock. It's now from 3 o'clock. He didn't move at all. And, you know, he knew he was on a good meditation. I was busy talking to other people. But Lynn just sat there on a chair waiting for him. And when he came out, Lynn very gently led him into one of the other rooms, a nice, dark, quiet room, so he could actually come out very gently and not be faced with people or with stuff to do. Very, very smart, Lynn Jackson, for doing that. And I really thanked her afterwards. Well done. Because otherwise, if you come out of jhana, you have to face people. Ooh, it's like crazy stuff. So if you see someone sitting in here a really long time, you know, don't worry about them eating something. They're not interested in food. You know, just afterwards, you know, lead them back into their rooms, sit them down, just relax. Because they're incredibly sensitive. But those are sort of the jhana stuff. So, you know, if you're stubborn and difficult to deal with afterwards, then you haven't really understood the meditation. And the fireworks come in, then you are really amazing afterwards. Similarly, why do lay people often get interesting meditative experience, but monastics who live peaceful, virtuous lives, why not? They do. But there's sometimes when you have virtue, it takes a bit longer, like they say, it's a simile of the Buddha. He said it's like the trees growing in the mountains compared to the trees growing in the plains. The trees growing in the plains, they can put their roots down very easily and they grow tall very quickly because they're in sandy soil. But when a storm comes, they're blown over. But the trees up in the mountains, they have to put their roots down in the cracks between the rocks to get the water, which means they take a longer time to grow. But when they do put those roots down into the cracks, when a wind blows, they're stuck to the mountain. They do not fall over. He said, that's like monks. You know, because it is a more restrained lifestyle, and because, you know, their virtue is not just for 9 days. You know, come on Monday, you can go and have dinner, you can have sex, you can watch your movies, you can do anything. Monks, come Monday, we're still monks. So because of that, it takes a longer time for some monks, but when it happens, it's strong. Same with nuns. So, and the monks do get these great states too. But it's, you know, when they do, the monks get them, nuns get them, that's really strong, because their foundation is rock. If lay people get jhanas, shouldn't they want to ordain? Yeah. That's what happens. People sometimes ask that question, it's a good question, is there any danger with getting jhanas? And I say, there's only one danger, and that is you might lose your hair. And it's true, because look, once you've tasted the jhanas, and you're really a real one, there's a lot of fake ones around, but you know, when you taste the real one, that just blows your mind. It's one of the reasons I became a monk. Had a girlfriend, had sex with her in Gloucester. 5 days later, I was having a meditation retreat and blissed out. And it was much, much, much better than sex with my girlfriend. We had good sex. But meditation was far, far, far better. And that really shocked me. It blew me away. And I remember at the time thinking, why has no one told me about this up to this point? Why didn't people tell me that, you know, there's something better? And after that, yeah, you know, you had a bit of sex, but you weren't that interested anymore. You had something way, way better. And that, I mean, if you experience that, that will make you think, you know, maybe, you know, just become a monk or a nun and just really get into this business. We're not monks or nuns because we're ascetic. We're into whipping ourselves and denying ourselves and just, you know, eating rubbishy food just because if it's painful, it must be good for you. We're in this for fun. I know more pleasure than you do. That's why I'm into this business of being a monk. Hee hee hee. Jhana doesn't necessarily always lead to wisdom. Correct, it doesn't always lead to wisdom, but without it, you won't get wisdom. Verse 372 of the Dhammapada. Nati jhanang apanyasa panya nati ajayato yam hi jhanang tapanya cha sarve nibbana santike. Now I say that sometimes to impress people, because sometimes people think Ajahn Brahm makes it up. But when I say this in Pali and quote it, wow, that's awesome. And what it means in English, there is no jhana without wisdom. Use wisdom power to get jhanas. There's no jhana without wisdom, that's verse 1, line 1. And there's no wisdom without jhana. But in the person who has jhana and wisdom, they are in the presence of nibbana. Knocking on the door. beautiful. You have to have wisdom to get jhana, and jhana creates the wisdom. And you got both together, you're really close. Something's going to happen. Da, da, da. And you've all got wisdom. You've learned so much. Your brains have been so highly trained by modern education. And you've got access to so many talks and teachings. You've got that part down. What you haven't got is the jhana. So that's why I always focus on this. Get yourself into jhana and the rest will be easy. Dear Ajahn Brahm, as you mentioned this morning, we are Theravada Buddhists and can't chant Om Mani Padme Hum. If we chant Om Mani Take Me Home, it's all right. Very good. It has been for many years, every morning just close to waking up, I am filled by fears. Sometimes because of worries for that day, and sometimes just out of nothing. Is it common? Is the mind generally weaker at this point of time? How to alleviate? Thank you. It's not that uncommon. Not everybody does that. You can train yourself. So I train myself. When you wake up in the morning, you jump out of bed. You don't think, oh God, what time it is. Can I have another 5 minutes? No, jump out of bed. Zippity-doo-dah! Another day! Yes! Put energy when you first wake up in the morning. Try that. Or maybe don't try that, because some of you are going to be waking up really early, going zippity-doo-dah, waking everybody else up, and I'll have this full of complaints tomorrow. Please, Ajahn Brahm, don't let them do that ever again. They woke me up at 3 o'clock with all this zippity-doo-dah nonsense. But at least you can wake up with some sort of energy when you come up. And filled by fears, it is because when you first wake up, your mindfulness is quite weak. And that's why sometimes you can actually knock over things, you know, when you first get up. And you know, not really knowing where you are and what you're doing. It takes you a little while to become aware. And that means that, you know, these little fears can actually get into you. But after a while, we can let go of those fears in everyday life. And one of the ways to overcome fears, I've mentioned many words which I've invented. You've got kindfulness already. And some person was saying, you know, what would have happened, Ajahn Brahm, if, you know, you didn't become a monk? Or what would happen if you hadn't ordained bhikkhunis? You know, would that have been better? What would happen if? And all these ifs are what keeps you thinking about the past. And I always say the past is ineffable. Not ineffable, but ineffable. You cannot if the past. You don't know what might happen if you'd have done something else. So why do you always think, oh, if I'd have only gone out with that boy, you know, he may have married me. If I'd have chosen another subject at school, you know, then I may be rich now. If I'd have only invested in Google 10 years ago, I'd be a millionaire now. All those ifs you can't say. So the past is ineffable. And as for the future, all fears are looking into the future with negativity and imagining all the things which might go wrong. That's called fear or anxiety. It's adding negativity to the future. So the way to overcome that is having a positive view of the future. Looking at the future and imagining all the things which might go right. That is called hope. So my saying is, don't be anxious, be hopey. H-O-P-E-Y. So don't worry, be hopey. And you know, I've said that enough times now, that somebody sent me an email saying that's in what is called the Urban Dictionary. So, you know, people listen to words and as they're used, and if they're used enough, they get put online in the Urban Dictionary. And after a while, if they get their currency, then they go into the real dictionaries, like, you know, Webster's or Collins or Oxford English Dictionary. So it's really nice to actually create words. And it's a nice word. I like that word, hopey. So if you're more hopey in life, in other words, more hope, then you actually don't be afraid. So, whoever says that, learn how to be hopey, not afraid. You've both got an even chance of success, you know, fear and hope, but hopey makes you happier. And also, you may know in life, what you're afraid of, you usually make happen. If you're hopey, what you hope for is more likely to happen. So, don't worry, be hopey. Dear Ajahn, could you say a few words about the different jhana states? I say very few words. They're beautiful. You didn't say to say lots of words. You said, say a few words. So I said a few words. If I said any more, I would be answering your question. I'll talk about jhanas in another day, one morning talk. Is it better to ask mind, body than mind? Today mind wanted to take a walk, but body wanted to rest first. You are a complicated person. Now, the mind is a forerunner in chief. So the mind runs the body. So ask the mind first and say the mind can check with the body what it wants to do. But the mind rules. So ask the mind. You often say we put ourselves in prison and put ourselves to hell, but can some of our intentions, i.e. karma, determine what happens in the future? How are we heirs to our karma, or is that only for the deluded? The karma of the past gives you the ingredients of the present. So you are an heir to your past karma. That makes you who you are, where you are, with all the ingredients you have in life. But the most important part of karma is what you do with those ingredients. So you can put yourself in a prison because of those ingredients. The past may mean you've been raped or even tortured. I'm being serious here. Big stuff. But that cell door, that hell door is open. It's really terrible ingredients. But I've seen many, many incredible people who've made a beautiful, beautiful meal of those ingredients. The worst ingredients and makes incredible life out of. That is the law of karma. You wouldn't believe just how freeing an understanding of karma is. You can do anything with even the worst ingredients and make an incredibly wonderful life. So you can make a prison of what's happened to you and allow yourself to be punished and tortured for years and years. Until one day you realize you can walk out. I said this to someone earlier, and it's a powerful thing. First time I told this to a psychologist, he thought it was impossible, but he looked at it and said, actually, you're right. All that past you can let go of in one go. You can walk out of the cell of your past, no matter how bad it was. It's a tough thing to do, but to know you can do it is the first step. You don't have to keep thinking about it and dealing with it and bringing it up. Okay, suppressing it doesn't work, but keep bringing it up also is not necessary. You can just let it go. It's called in Buddhism ahosi karma. Karma that was let go of, abandoned, finished. And to know you can do that totally undermines modern psychology. You don't need to go back ever again. You've finished. You've let it go in one hit. And how you do that is realize that wasn't you. Nothing to do with me. Another being, another person, the sense of owning and being identifying with that past is cut. It takes a lot of wisdom, but Buddhism can do this. And people do it. They totally let it go. Terrible things. And then they're free of the past. And they no longer need to be in hell. They simply walk out. Brilliant to do. And when you see that, that's really, really powerful. So that's the law of karma is more, what do we call it, more freeing than you can ever believe. Because the karma of the past, that gives you the ingredients. But you're totally free, 100% free, to make whatever you like out of what you've got. That's why you see it is incredible. In the times of Buddha, people became totally enlightened. And there's one person, Patachara, she was actually crazy. She was a mad woman. There was Badia, who was deformed. He was a dwarf. There was Chulapantaka, who was really, you call him intellectually disabled. You know, he became, like, he couldn't remember anything. He couldn't sort of understand any teachings. His brother just gave him a piece of cloth to keep wiping his hands until he realized, you know, when it's used, it degrades. You know, it's an impermanence thing, which he saw. He saw it so deeply, he became enlightened too. It's incredible. You know, serial killer Angulimala, he became enlightened. With all that bad karma of a serial killer, or, you know, somehow intellectually or physically disabled, these people, you know, prostitutes became arahats, you know, nuns. It's actually amazing. So, you know, yeah, there's some bad karma there, but they could put that bad karma together and make incredible lives, be saints. And I always remember Patachara, absolutely crazy, because she lost her husband, her children, and her parents all on the same day. She lost her mind. And after that, she became fully enlightened and one of the greatest of all teachers. Read the Therigata. And when I read that, I kept on reading all these nuns in the time of the Buddha, getting nowhere. And they said, this nun came and taught them how to meditate properly. And they all got enlightened, one after the other. And there's all this Patachara. She really knew her stuff. And so she took, you know, incredible disaster and pain, which drove her out of her mind, and used that to become one of the greatest teachers in the time of the Buddha. A woman, brilliant teacher. So that's, you can use anything. It's amazing what you can do. So that's why, you know, about karma makes it interesting for you. Sometimes it makes it difficult. But, you know, again, that shit story, if you have lots of shit, you can make the most delicious mangoes. It's hard, though, but you can do it. Anyway, the Buddha talked about the benefits of metta for those who cultivated, but how come he didn't mention the benefits of compassion for the individual who's cultivated, or did he? The main one I can think of is connecting with others. Can you please mention some other benefits of compassion for the individual? Maybe if we can understand, we won't suffer from compassion fatigues. Thank you, with metta. It's usually like metta, loving kindness, includes compassion. We say, may all beings be happy and well. But the compassion in Buddhism, may all suffering beings be happy and well. So, you know, loving kindness is for everybody. May the happy people and the hungry people, may all people be happy and well. So metta is encompassing everything. And, you know, the compassion is for those people who are suffering and sick. So metta includes compassion, which is why when you say the benefits of metta, it also includes the benefit of compassion. Ajahn Brahm, yesterday you mentioned about nuns in California that lived at Moldy House. It was actually a monastery, it was a forest. And eventually had to leave due to health reasons. Are they Ayatataloka? She was one of them. Please advise a place, name, maybe we can help something so that they can have a proper kuti. If you want to ask, ask Venerable Karunika, because she stayed there, so she knows what we're talking about. So if you want to help, Karunika is the one to go to. And I might say this, that the nuns monastery, the Sala project, which, you know, Venerable Karunika is working so hard for, we've just about got enough money for that. So you don't have to give the money for that one. You can, if you really want to, give it for the nuns over in America. And I say that you have got enough. I've been looking at the accounts. You can always want more, you know, but... Dear Ajahn, getting the funds for the Sala project at Dharma Sala, it's incredible just how generous people have been. and it just money keeps coming in. And it really blows my mind just how each one of you and in all the other countries have just really sort of come to the party and just said, no, we want this to happen. And I really want it to happen. So they've really given lots of money for this. It really impresses me. If there is non-self, then who is saying to be kind and being gentle to the mind? Your mouth is saying that. You know, every now and again, you know, sometimes when you hear jokes, do you ever wonder, where did that come from? Because they go around on the internet, you hear from someone, but who started those jokes? You know, actually, I put my hand up, there's a couple of jokes which I actually invented. So there's people like me who actually start the jokes, and they go around, and every time it actually you hear it back again. It comes round. You say, I remember that, that's what I said. And one of those jokes is the Buddhist joke, and it's an old Zen story of these two monks who saw the flag move in the wind. And one monk said to the other, the flag is moving. And the other monk said, no, the wind is moving. And so they went to the Zen master to settle their argument. And he said, was the wind moving or was the flag moving? And the Zen master said, you're both wrong. Your mind was moving. And they weren't really that satisfied with a smart aleck Zen monk. So they went to the Theravada forest monk. And he said, no, who's right? The Zen master said the mind was moving, or the monk who said the mouth was moving, or the monk who said the wind was moving. And the Theravada forest monk said, all three of you were wrong. Your mouths were moving. And I invented that one, and that got round in a joke, which came on the internet, which somebody sent to me. So we're very practical as Buddhist monks. It's your mouth was moving, that was the problem. So this particular one, if there is no sense, then who is saying to be kind and gentle to the mind? The thing which wrote this question, that is what is saying to the mind. Om Mani Padme Hum works. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. I can't resist answering this question with, I told you so. Of course it works. Dear Ajahn, okay. Here we go. This is a serious question. So, this is a real situation. My brother-in-law is suffering of short breath and asked to go for triple bypass, open heart surgery in Sri Lanka. My sister-in-law is left with 15% lung capacity and asked to go for a lung transplant in Australia. Shouldn't they reconsider the decision to end of suffering, taking medicine in the... Shouldn't they reconsider their decision to end of suffering, taking medication in the rest of their life? Seek how you look at above. Okay. It's suffering from short breath and wants to go for triple bypass operation. Sister-in-law wants to go for a lung transplant in Australia. Now, all of those are very, very difficult, and they're also very, very expensive. And, of course, that's why you have to look at how old they are, you know, what the quality of life is. And if they know they're 60, 70, 80 years of age or something, you know, it's not worth it anymore. Just to extend your life at such expense, you know, let that lung be given to someone who's much younger, who has a much longer lifespan. So that is why we have to make ethical decisions and not selfish decisions. Yeah, if that was your mother, you think, no, no, that's my mum, she's really important. But please, it's not your mother, it's the person as well. And so sometimes we have to stand back without attachment, whether it's your brother-in-law or sister-in-law, or your mother or your wife or even your child, and think, no, let's get the information. Is it really worthwhile spending all that money and all those resources? Could they be better used somewhere else? And sometimes the answer is to let people go. In Buddhism, it's not such a bad thing because they'll get a much better body next time. So they can get a real heart transplant with a new body as well. Sometimes when you've got a car, just replacing the carburetor is just a waste of time because everything else is falling apart. It's time to get a new vehicle. And there's nothing wrong with that. So when we're not so afraid of death, then we make much wiser decisions and kinder decisions. So it's really up to, you know, the situation is obviously complex, you need much more information. Last night I had a nightmare. Every time I come to meditation retreat, after 3 or 4 days I have a nightmare. Why is that? It depends what the nightmare is. Because if it is a real scary nightmare, please write it down in detail and send it to Hollywood. That could be a script for the next movie. Because people like horror movies and nightmares can be very, very creative. So don't waste it. So I say, all shit is good for the mango tree. So don't waste it. So next time we have a nightmare, had a great nightmare last night. This makes a really good script. I'm sure many of the movies like Alien started off as did Steven Spielberg do Alien? I don't know. Steven Spielberg's nightmare. He had a nightmare one day of being chased by a shark. And we have Jaws. So you could be able to retire after you write down your nightmares. And you can give half the money to the nuns' monastery in California as well. Win, win, win. Why are you afraid of nightmares? What's wrong with nightmares? You know, I had nightmares when I first ordained as a monk. The first about week, I'd wake up in the middle of the night in Bangkok with a nightmare, sweating. And you know what my nightmare was? It was that I wasn't a monk, that I was a layman. And as soon as I opened my eyes and saw my robes next to the mat on which I was sleeping, I'm a monk, yes. And then I went into this deep, peaceful sleep. No joking, that happened. That's how much I wanted to be a monk. And I was so terrified of not being a monk, that's why I had a nightmare. So, you know, I'm really into this monk business. So it really depends what the nightmare is. But if it's a recurring nightmare, what to do? If it's always 3 or 4 nights into retreat, when you go to bed, just you're in your bed, you're comfortable, before you go to sleep, just you can tell yourself, I will have peaceful dreams. I will have peaceful dreams. I will have peaceful dreams. And you will be surprised how effective that is. You won't have nightmares, you'll have peaceful dreams. You're reconditioning yourself. And that time when you're comfortable in bed, really relaxed, your mind is very open to conditioning. The other thing you can do is you can say, when you're in your bed, you're lying down there, if I have a nightmare, Ajahn Brahm, please come and sort it out. And then you start this nightmare and you have this vision of me, Superman, coming to save you from whatever nightmare you have. Because actually somebody said this the other day, that they had a nightmare of like falling. And that really scared them. And I said, tell yourself when you go to bed tonight, is Ajahn Brahm, the monks and the nuns will be there with their robes. You know, just like the firemen. And they will catch you in their robes. So you fall and Ajahn Brahm says, Olay, I've caught you. Actually, that's a joke about the Olay joke. About there was a fire in Madrid, and there's a person was on a story. They were caught up the top there in a story, and at the last moment the Spanish fire brigade came and they got out that thing you jump into. They say jump, and a woman jumped, and just before they hit the cloth, Olay. Spain, you know, full pipe, ole. But if in your dream, we won't do that for you. Your emptiness, that's more like it. If our minds are so big that the universe can fit into our minds, then won't our minds collide? Or is it really just one big mind after all? That's interesting. We'll go and find out. Is your mind my mind? At least we do interfere with each other. And we do influence each other. Collide. I don't think collide is the right word. We can have loving kindness with each other. So minds can help each other, but not collide. Ajahn, seriously. I can't do serious. Okay, the first question I've already said. How did you feel when you first became a monk, say in the first year? I've already said about that, that the first few days I had nightmares of not being a monk, and that really taught me a lot of how much I wanted to become a monk. And I kept telling people once I was a monk, this is for life. As soon as I became a monk, this is what I always wanted to do. It felt right. And it's one of those wonderful feelings, you know, in life, very fortunate feelings. If you meet someone and say, this is my partner, you know it. I'm going to be with this guy, this girl for life. And some people have that feeling, they know it, and they have this wonderful relationship together. And other times it's a job which just fits you. Now, you may be working here, working there, and you get this job in environmental science or whatever, and say, I'm so passionate, I love this job. And then you're again fortunate. And that's what happened to me being a monk. As soon as I became a monk, this is what I always wanted to do. This is who I am. And as I told all my friends, I'm going to be a monk for life. Yeah, yeah, everybody says that. And now I can say, you see, it reminds me of that guy who said that he wanted to be a professional stand-up comedian. He said when he told that to his teacher and friends laughed at him. Now he is a famous comedian. They're not laughing now. That was actually a famous joke from a comedian. So I really wanted to. A few years down the road, still really into it. Now after 40 years, the best 40 years of my life. If I had it all over again, the only thing I would change is becoming a monk earlier. I love being a monk, it's a great lifestyle. Because the two things I wanted to achieve in life, personal happiness, you know, I've got personal happiness, I'm having a great time. And number two, being able to give happiness to others. And I'm doing that too. And look, seriously, imagine what it's like when you get a letter from somebody or they come and visit you and they burst out in crying. Ajahn Brahm, I was going through a divorce or going through a cancer. And I read your book, I heard your talks on YouTube, and they turned my whole life around. I survived. The cancer's gone. The divorce never happened. I'm with my partner and my kids. We're having a wonderful time. Thank you. To do one of those things will give you so much fulfillment. And that's happened, I want to say, not hundreds, probably a couple of thousand times. I got letters packed into my inner drawer, all these letters people keep sending me. Now that's called fulfillment, when you really have helped people. So I'm having a great time as a monk. Haven't you missed the material enjoyment of the lay people? Are you kidding? You know, sometimes you go to people's houses. And in my place now, as a monk, sometimes you've got enough fame, you go to rich people's houses. You know, go to the president of Sri Lanka's palace. Now, who's that guy, Sri Datu Danny Lim or something? You know, he's multi-billionaire in, was at Kuala Lumpur. You meet all these people who are mega wealthy. And no way I'd like to be like that. You can see they're just totally screwed up in their head. And I've also met these, I was saying in Cambridge, Nobel laureates. I remember having dinner with some guy who wrote Nobel laureate in chemistry some years ago. I don't want to be like that. And you see, like an Ajahn Chah, I want to be like that. Beautiful, peaceful, happy monk. So, I haven't missed anything. Is it okay to become a monk at 60? Why not? If you're healthy enough in this space. My problem now is, and it's a big problem with nuns, monastery, monks, monasteries, so many people want to become a monk and a nun. We've got this huge waiting list. And you know, quite seriously, that hurts me. There's one thing you say, what's my biggest suffering right now? And quite honestly, it's because there's no way I can make the opportunities available for all the people who deserve it. There's a lot of people who deserve to be monks and nuns, and they really ask, they want to, and it's just the logistics. And it's not even the money, it's the blooming councils and planning regulations and other laws. No, you can't have more huts on this land, or if you have a hut, you've got to build it this way and that way, which is not a hut anymore for a monk, it's a house. And there's just such difficulty stopping you. It was in Thailand or even in Malaysia or Indonesia, sometimes it's so easy. But Australia, the laws which you have to fulfill to do anything, it's just so onerous. And that means, yeah, I'd love to have you, but there's no space. In KL, again, if you have a branch monastery, then most of the people, please excuse me, but they say, no, we want to stay with you, Ajahn Brahm. We want you around. And they even complain when I go overseas. And that's the reason why I don't eat here, because I want to be with my monks over there. They want to see you every day. And you can understand that. So, you know, this is why it's so difficult. So eventually, you know, when you get some monks who want to sort of take on those jobs of, you know, a monastery in KL or wherever, fine. But you've got to get sort of the teachers as well and the opportunities to inspire people. See what happens. There's always, when you put these things out, there's always some solution comes up later on. Because I'm not anxious about this. I'm not worried. I am Hopi. Very good. Thank you for a lovely evening and great questions. So hopefully I've answered them as best as possible. And I have actually put a lot of effort into asking the questions more slowly. Some of them are fast, but I've tried. If I failed, well, there we go. Remember what I said earlier. If I failed and you're disappointed, please complain to Dania. I only receive praise. No, anything goes. So let's... Oh, I forgot. The three sadhus. Sadhu! 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 People always get the giggles just before they go to bed on the fourth or fifth day of a retreat. It's giggle time. Very good. So good night, everybody. Those who want to meditate, meditate some more. When you want to go to bed, go to bed. And if you have nightmares, please, you know, make the determination. May Ajahn Brahm come to save me when I'm falling. May I have a beautiful dream. It actually works. Good night.